Hello friends, the new topic, the precursors of the Romantic Revival or the transitional poets. Introduction. The 18th century is usually known as the century of prose and reason, the age in which neoclassicism reigned supreme and in which all romantic tendencies lay dormant, if not extinct, but that is verdict too sweeping to be true. In this century, especially the latter part of it, we can see numerous cracks in the classical edifice through which seems to be peeping the multicolored light of the Romanticism. In the latter years of this century, a large number of new influences were a work on English sensibility and temper. The change signalized a change in the ethos of poetry and, in fact, literature as a whole. The younger poet started breaking away from the school of Dryden and Pope, even though some poets like Churchill and Dr. Johnson are still elected to remain in the old groove. There were very few poets, indeed, who set themselves completely free from the old traditional influences. Most of them are, as it were, like Mr. Fassing, both ways, looking simultaneously at a neoclassical past and the romantic future. They seem to be placed on this isthmus of a middle state. In the selection of subject or poetic treatment, in the choice of the verse pattern, and in the manner of treatment, we meet with perceptible change from the convention of the Popian school. Those 18th century poets who show some element associated with romanticism hold, not altogether ignoring the old convention, are called transitional poet or the precursor of the romantic revival. Let us sum up the romantic qualities of the poetry of these transitional poets. First, these poets believe in the Victor Hughes described as liberalism and literature, not much worried about rules and conventions. They believe in individual poetic inspiration. Second, their poetry is not altogether intellectual in the content and treatment. Passion, emotion, and the imagination are valued by them above the cold light of intellectuality. They naturally return to the lyric. Third, they have, to quote Hudson, a love of the wild, fantastic, abnormal, and supernatural. Fourth, they show a new appreciation of the world of nature, which the neoclassical poetry had mostly neglected. Their poetry is no longer drawing room poetry. They do not limit their attention to urban life and manner only, as Pope almost always did. Fifth, they place more importance on the individual than on society. In them, therefore, it is to be seen at work a stronger democratic spirit, a greater concern for the oppressed and the poor, and a greater emphasis on individualism in poetry, in society, everywhere. Their poetry becomes much more subjective. Sixth, they show a much greater interest in the Middle Ages, which Dryden and Pope had neglected on account of their alleged barbarousness. Dryden and Pope admire the Renaissance much more and had many a spiritual link with it. Seventh, lastly, there is a strong reaction against the heroic couplet as a only eligible verse unit. They make experiment with new measure and stanzaic form. It is said that every hero ends as a war. The same was the case with the heroic couplet. While exhibiting all these above listed tendencies in their poetic works, the transitional poets are not, however, altogether free from Popian influence. That is exactly why they are not full-fledged romantics, but only transitional poets. Nevertheless, their work proves the 18th century was an age of reason, but the channels of romanticism were never dry. Let us now consider the work of most important and the transitional poets of the 18th century. James Thomson, 1700-48. He is a typical transitional poet, though he chronologically belonged to the first half of the 18th century, though he was contemporaneous with Pope, yet he broke away from the tradition of his school to explore fresh woods and postures new. He bid goodbye to the heroic couplet and expressed himself in other verse, measures, blank verse, and Spenserian stanza. He would have acknowledged Spenser and Milton as his guide rather than Dryden and Pope. His Seasons 1726-13 is important for accurate and sympathetic description of natural scene. It is entirely different from such poem as Pope's Windsor Forest on account of poet's first-hand knowledge of what he is describing and his intimate rapport with it. The poem is in blank verse, written obviously after the manner of Milton, but sometimes it seems to be overstrained, always lowering uphill. In the word of Hazlitt, Thomson's Liberty is a very long poem. In it, Liberty herself is made to narrate her checkered career through the ages in Greek, Rome, and England. The theme is dull and abstract, the narration uninteresting, and the blank verse ponderous. His Castle of Indolence, 1748, is in Spenserian stanza, and it captures much of the luxuriant, imaginative color of the Elizabethan poet. As a critic puts it, for language, suggestiveness, indulgent and harmonious versification, and for subtly woven vowel music, it need not shrink comparison with the best of Spenser himself. Thomson looked forward to the Romantics in his interest in nature, in treating of new subject, his strong imagination, and his giving up the heroic couplet, but he is capable of some very erroneous example of poetic diction. Even Dr. Johnson was constrained to observe, his diction is in the highest degree florid or luxuriant. It is too exuberant and sometimes may be charged with filling the air more than the mind. Oliver Goldsmith, 1728-74. Goldsmith was friendly with Dr. Johnson, had been with Pope, but that did not curb the individual genius of either. Goldsmith was as essentially a conservative in literary theory as Dr. Johnson, of whose club he was an eminent member. Both of his important poem, The Traveller, 1764, and The Deserted Village, 1770, are in heroic couplet. The first poem is didactic after Johnson's usually practice and is concerned with the description and criticism of the place and people in Europe which Goldsmith had visited as a tramp. The second poem is rich in natural description and is vibrant with a peculiar note of sentiment and melancholy which foreshadows 19th century romantic. As in the first poem, Goldsmith exhibits the tenderness of his feeling for poor villagers. Thomas Percy, 1728-1811. Percy is known in the history of English literature not for original poetry but for his compilation of ballads, sonnets, historical song, and metrical romances, which he published in 1765 under the title Reliques of Ancient English Poetry. The work did a lot to revive public interest in that kind of poetry which had gone out of vogue in the age of Dryden and Poe. The book contained poetry from different ages, from the Middle Ages to reign of Charles. The work had a tremendous and lasting popularity about its influence on the poets who were to come we may quote Wordsworth in inverted comma, I do not think that there is an able writer in verse of the present day who would not be proud to acknowledge his obligation of the reliquies. Inverted comma closed. Even Dr. Johnson forward Percy Venture and earned his thanks for, by lending him a hand in the compilation. Thomas Chatterton, 1752-17. Chatterton is referred by the Wordsworth in his poem Resolution and Independence as the marvelous boy, the sleepless soul that perished in his pride. Chatterton indeed was a marvelous boy who sought into fame and then, before he was 18, poisoned himself with arsenic, getting sick of his poverty. Some of his poems are quite Augustan in their matter and form, but the most characteristic poems are the ones he published as the work of Thomas Rowley, a 15th century monk who lived in Bristol, Chatterton's native place. Chatterton gave out that he had discovered them in a box lying in a Bristol church. His hoax was soon seen through, but that does not detract from the merit of the Rowley poem. The poems like Ella and Ballad of Charity and according to Hudson, quite remarkable for two reasons. Inverted comma. Because they are probably the most wonderful things ever written by a boy of Chatterton's age, and because by are another clear indication of the fast-growing curiosity of critics and the public regarding everything belonging to the Middle Age. Chatterton's work considerably influenced the Romantic poets who were intensely interested in everything medieval. James Macpherson, 1736-96. He was another forger like Chatterton, though his work was not altogether baseless. His first achieved fame with fragment of ancient poetry collected in the Highland of Scotland and translated from the Gaelic or Erse language, which were given out of to be genuine remain of ancient Scottish poet. Later he produced Fingal, an epic poem in 6 books, 1762, and then Temora, an epic poem in 8 book, 1763. Macpherson asserted that these two poems were the genuine work of a Gaelic bard of 3rd century named Ossian, and that he had given their literal translation in prose. His claims provoke an acrimonious controversy as to their genuineness. Fortunately, say Hudson, in inverted comma, we need not enter into the discussion in order to appreciate the epoch-making character of Macpherson's work. In the loosely rhythmical prose which he adopted for his so-called translation, he carried to an extreme and formal reaction of the time against the classical couplet. In matter and spirit, he is widely romantic. In order to come closed. His poem transport the reader to a new world of heroism and the supernaturalism tinged with melancholy, a world which is altogether different from the sparse and responsible world of Pope. Thomas Gray, 1716-71. Gray was one of the most learned men of the Europe of his day. He is also a genuine poet, but his poetic production is lamentably small, just a few odd. Some miscellaneous poems and the elegy. He started his career as a straight-jacketed classicist and ended as a genuine romantic. His work, according to Hudson, is a kind of epitome of the change which were coming over the literature of his time. His first attempts, The Alliance of Education and Government, and the Ode on a Distant Prospect of Eton College, were classical in spirit and the first mentioned even in its use of the heroic couplet. Elegy written in Chen Country Churchyard is Gray's finest poem, which earned him a praise to Evan Johnson, who condemned most of Gray's poetry. Hudson observed about his poem in inverted comma, "There is first of use of nature, which thou employed only a background, only as a background, as is still handled with fidelity and sympathy. There is next the churchyard scene, the twilight atmosphere, and the brooding melancholy of the poem, which at once connect it with one side of the romantic movement in the development of the distinctive romantic mood, the contrast drawn between the country and the town, the peasant simple life and the madding crowd ignoble strip, is a third particular which will be noted. Finally, in the tender feeling shown for the rude forefather of the Hamlet, and the sense of the human value of the little thing that are written in the sort of in simple annals of the poor, we see poetry under the influence of a spreading democratic spirit reaching out of include humble aspect of life hitherto ignored." Gray's next poem, The Progress of Poesy and the Bard, present a new conception of the poet not as a clever versifier but a genuinely inspired and prophetic genius. His last poem, like The Fatal Sister and The Descent of Odin, or romantic fragment with which we step out of the 18th century and find ourselves in the full stream of romanticism. William Collins, 1721-59. Collins' work is as thin in bulk as Gray's. It does not extend to much more than 1500 lines. He combines in himself the neoclassical and the romantic element, though he is not without a specific manner which is all his own. On the one hand, he provides numerous examples of poetic diction at its worst, on the other, he delights in the highly romantic world of shadow and the supernatural. His ode on the popular superstition of the Highland foreshadows the world in which Coleridge delight. He is chiefly known for his ode to liberty, and the one mentioned above are the lengthiest of Collins odes, but he is at his best in shorter flight. He is exquisite when he eschews poetic diction without losing his delightful singing quality. Referring to Collins, Swinburne maintained that in purity of music and the clarity of style, there is no parallel in English verse from the death of Marvell of the birth of William Blake. William Cowper, 1731-1800. He says, Campton Rickett, in inverted comma, is a blend of the old and the new, with much of the form of the old and something of the spirit of the new. In his satire, he imitated the manner of Pope, but his greatest poem, The Task, is all his own. It is written in blank verse and contains the famous line, "God made the country and men made the town," which indicate his love of nature and simplicity. However, the classical element in him is more predominant than the romantic. Campton Rickett maintains in inverted comma, "We shall find in his work neither the passion nor the strangeness of the romantic school. Much in his nature disposed to shape him as a poet of classicism. And with occasional reserve, he is far more of a classical poet than a romantic." Throughout Cowper's work, we feel from time to time a note of something that is certainly not the note of Pope and Dryden, something deeper in feeling that meets us even in Thomson, Collins or Gray. There is a tenderness in poem like My Mother's Picture that not even Goldsmith is his words can quite equal, while his fresh and intimate nature pictures point to a stage in the development of poetic naturalism more considerable than we find in Thomson and his immediate successor in order to come a closed. George Crabbe, 1754-1832. He mostly continued the neoclassical tradition and was derisively viewed as a pope in worst stocking. In his poetry, which is mostly descriptive of the miseries of poor villagers, he was an uncompromising, unromantic realist. He assured a paint of paint the court as truth will paint it and as bards will not. He showed much concern for villagers, but he left for Wordsworth to glorify their simplicity and even penury. Crabbe's excessive boldness as a realist alienates him for the policy of the neoclassical school. However, he tenaciously adhered to the heroic couplet even when he was a contemporary of Blake and Romantic poets. Robert Burns, 1759-95. He was a Scottish peasant who took the poetry and became the truly national poet of Scotland. His work poem chiefly in the Scottish dialect, Sky, 1786, skyrocketed him to fame. All these poems are imbued with the spirit of romantic lyricism in its untutored spontaneity, humor, pathos and sympathy with nature and her lowly creatures, including the sons of soil. Sometime indeed Burns tries to write in the correct manner of the Popian school, but then he becomes unimpressive and spied. A critic observed in an odd comma, Burns was a real peasant who dropped the plow. He hummed his song and who knew all the wretchedness of and joy and sorrow and countryman's life. Sincerity and passion are the chief keys of his verse. Burns can utter a piercing lyric cry as in a fond kiss and then we sever. Can be gracefully sentimental as in My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose. Can be crossly witty as in The Jolly Beggars. But he is always sincere and passionate, and that is why his words so straight into the heart. In order to come closed. Burns was influenced a great deal by the spirit of French Revolution. His fellow feeling extended even to the lower animal whom he studied minutely and treated sympathetically. William Blake, 1757-1827. Blake was an out and out rebel against all the social, political and liberty convention of the 18th century. It is with considerable inaccuracy that he can be included among the transitional poets or the precursor of the Romantic revival, as in many ways he is even more romantic than the Romantic poets. The most undisciplined and the most lonely of all poets, he lived in his own world, peopled by phantoms and specters who he treated as more real than the humdrum realities of the physical world. His glorification of childhood and feeling for nature make him akin to the Romantic poets. He is best known for his three thin volume poetical sketches, 1783, Song of Innocence, 1789, and Song of Experience, 1794, which contains some of the most orient gems of English lyricism. A critic observed in inverted comma, his passion for freedom was also akin to that
which moved Wordsworth Coleridge and Southey in their earlier years, though in its latter form it came nearer to Shelley's revolt against convention. There he indeed an unusual degree of fellowship between these two, the imagery of symbolism as well as the underlying spirit, the revolt of Islam, Ulster, and the Prometheus Unbound, find their nearest parallel in Blake's prophetic books. Both had vision of a world regenerated by a gospel of universal brotherhood transcending law. The topic, transitional poets, over.